Welcome to the Savitri Reading Group on Infinite Conversations. I'm here with Andrea and Jeffrey. Matteo and John Robert can't be here today. And we're going back into Canto 6, The Kingdoms and Godheads of the Greater Life. We had done half of a complete reading of the canto last time, and so we're going to pick it up on page 191 with Ever He Felt Near a Spirit, with Andrea, followed by Jeffrey, and then myself, taking turns. But first, the meditation. Okay.
Ever he felt near a spirit in her forms. Its passive presence was her nature's strength. This soul is real in apparent things. Even upon earth, the spirit is life's key. But her solid outsides nowhere bear its trace. Its stamp on her acts is undiscoverable. The pathos of lost heights is its appeal. Only sometimes is caught a shadowy line that seems a hint of veiled reality. Life stared at him with vague, confused outlines, offering a picture the eyes could not keep, a story that was yet not written there. As in a fragmentary half-lost design, life's meanings fled from the pursuing eye. Life's visage hides life's real self from sight. Life's secret sense is written within, above. The thought that gives it sense lives far beyond. It is not seen in its half-finished design. In vain we hope to read the baffling signs or find the word of the half-played charade. Only in that greater life a cryptic thought is found, is hinted some interpreting word that makes the earth myth a tale intelligible. Something was seen at last that looked like truth. In a half-lit air of hazardous mystery, the eye that looks at the dark half of truth made out an image mid a vivid blur, and peering through a mist of subtle tints, he saw a half-blind, chained divinity, bewildered by the world in which he moved, yet conscious of some light prompting his soul. Attracted to strange, far-off shimmerings, led by the fluting of a distant player, he sought his way amid life's laughter and call and the index chaos of her myriad steps towards some total, deep infinitude. Around crowded the forest of her signs. At hazard, he read by arrow leaps of thought that hit the mark by a guess or luminous chance, her changing colored road lights of idea and her signals of uncertain swift event, the hieroglyphs of her symbol pageantries and her landmarks in the tangled paths of time.
In her mazes of approach and of retreat to every side, she draws him and repels, but drawn too near escapes from his embrace. All ways she leads him, but no way is sure. Allured by the many-toned marvel of her chant, attracted by the witchcraft of her moods, and moved by her casual touch to joy and grief, he loses himself in her, but wins her not. A fugitive paradise smiles at him from her eyes. He dreams of her beauty made forever his. He dreams of his mastery her limbs shall bear. He dreams of the magic of her breasts of bliss. In her illumined script, her fanciful translation of God's pure original text, he thinks to read the scripture wonderful, hieratic key to unknown beatitudes. But the word of life is hidden in its script. The chant of life has lost its divine note. Unseen, a captive in a house of sound, the spirit lost in the splendor of a dream listens to a thousand-voiced illusion's ode. A delicate weft of sorcery steals the heart, or a fiery magic tints her tones and hues. Yet they but wake a thrill of transient grace, a vagrant march struck by the wanderer time. They call to a brief, unsatisfied delight, or wallow in ravishments of mind and sense, but miss the luminous answer of the soul. A blind heart throb that reaches joy through tears, a yearning toward peaks forever unreached, an ecstasy of unfulfilled desire, track the last heavenward climbings of her voice.
Transmuted our past sufferings' memories into an old sadness's sweet escaping trail. Turned are her tears to gems of diamond pain, her sorrow into a magic crown of song. Brief are her snatches of felicity that touch the surface, then escape or die. A lost remembrance echoes in her depths. A deathless longing is hers, a veiled self's call. A prisoner in the mortal's limiting world, a spirit wounded by life sobs in her breast. A cherished suffering is her deepest cry. A wanderer on forlorn, despairing routes, along the roads of sound, a frustrate voice, forsaken cries to a forgotten bliss. Astray in the echo caverns of desire, it guards the phantoms of a soul's dead hopes, and keeps alive the voice of perished things, or lingers upon sweet and errant notes, hunting for pleasure in the heart of pain. A fateful hand has touched the cosmic chords, and the intrusion of a troubled strain covers the inner music's hidden key that guides unheard the surface cadences. Yet is it joy to live and to create, and joy to love and labor though all fails, and joy to seek though all we find deceives, and all on which we lean betrays our trust. Yet something in its depths was worth the pain. A passionate memory haunts with ecstasy's fire. Even grief has joy hidden beneath its roots, for nothing is truly vain the one has made. In our defeated hearts, God's strength survives, and victory's star still lights our desperate road. Our death is made a passage to new worlds. This to life's music gives its anthem swell. To all she lends the glory of her voice. Heaven's raptures whisper to her heart and pass. Earth's transient yearnings cry from her lips and fade.
Alone, the God-given hymn escapes her art that came with her from her spiritual home, but stopped halfway and failed. The silent word, awake in some deep pause of waiting worlds, a murmur suspended in eternity's hush, but no breath comes from the supernal peace. A sumptuous interlude occupies the ear, and the heart listens, and the soul consents. An evanescent music it repeats, wasting on transience time's eternity. A tremolo of the voices of the hours, oblivious, screens the high intended theme, the self-embodying spirit came to play on the vast clavichord of nature forms. Only a mighty murmur here and there of the eternal word, the blissful voice, or beauty's touch transfiguring heart and sense, a wandering splendor and a mystic cry recalls the strength and sweetness heard no more. Here is the gap. Here stops or sinks life's force. This deficit paupers the magician's skill. This want makes all the rest seem thin and bare. A half sight draws the horizon of her acts. Her depths remember what she came to do, but the mind has forgotten or the heart mistakes. In nature's endless lines is lost the God. In knowledge to sum up omniscience, in action to erect the omnipotent, to create her creator here was her heart's conceit, to invade the cosmic scene with utter God. Toiling to transform the still far absolute into an all-fulfilling epiphany, into an utterance of the ineffable, she would bring the glory here of the Absolute's force, change poise into creation's rhythmic swing, marry with a sky of calm, a sea of bliss.
A fire to call eternity into time, make body's joy as vivid as the soul's. Earth, she would lift a neighborhood with heaven, labor's life to equate with the supreme and reconcile the eternal and the abyss. Her pragmatism of the transcendent truth fills silence with the voices of the gods, but in the cry of the single voice is lost. For nature's vision climbs beyond her acts. A life of gods in heaven she sees above, a demigod emerging from an ape is all she can in our mortal element. Here the half-god, the half-titan, are her peak. This great life wavers twixt earth and sky. A poignant paradox pursues her dreams. Her hooded energy moves an ignorant world to look for a joy her own strong clasp puts off. In her embrace, it cannot turn to its source. Immense her power, endless her act's vast drive. Astray is its significance and lost. Although she carries in her secret breast the law and journeying curve of all things born, her knowledge partial seems, her purpose small. On a soil of yearning tread her sumptuous hours. A leaden nescience weighs the wings of thought. Her power oppresses the being with its garbs. Her actions prison its immortal gaze. A sense of limit haunts her masteries, and nowhere is assured content or peace. For all the depth and beauty of her work, a wisdom lacks that sets the spirit free. An old and faded charm had now her face, and palled for him her quick and curious lore. His wise soul asked a deeper joy than hers.
Out of her daedal lines he sought escape, but neither gate of horn nor ivory he found, nor postern of spiritual sight. There was no issue from that dreamlike space. Our being must move eternally through time. Death helps us not. Vain is the hope to cease. A secret will compels us to endure. Our life's repose is in the infinite. It cannot end. Its end is life supreme. Death is a passage, not the goal of our walk. Some ancient deep impulsion labors on. Our souls are dragged as with a hidden leash, carried from birth to birth, from world to world. Our acts prolong after the bodies fall, the old perpetual journey without pause. No silent peak is found where time can rest. This was a magic stream that reached no sea. However far he went, wherever turned, the wheel of works ran with him and outstripped. Always a farther task was left to do. A beat of action and a cry of search forever grew in that unquiet world. A busy murmur filled the heart of time. All was contrivance and unceasing stir. 100 ways to live were tried in vain. A sameness that assumed 1,000 forms strove to escape from its long monotone and made new things that soon were like the old. A curious decoration lured the eye, and novel values furbished ancient themes to cheat the mind with the idea of change. a different picture that was still the same appeared upon the cosmic vague background. Only another labyrinthine house of creatures and their doings and events, a city of the traffic of bound souls, a market of creation and her wares was offered to the laboring mind and heart.
The circuit ending where it first began is dubbed the forward and eternal march of progress on perfection's unknown road. Each final scheme leads to a sequel plan. Yet every new departure seems the last. Inspired evangel, theory's ultimate peak, proclaiming a panacea for all time's ills, or carrying thought in its ultimate zenith flight and trumpeting supreme discovery. Each brief idea, a structure perishable, publishes the immortality of its rule, its claim to be the perfect form of things, truth's last epitome, time's golden best. But nothing has been achieved of infinite worth. A world made ever anew, never complete, piled always half attempts on lost attempts, and saw a fragment as the eternal whole. In the aimless mounting total of things done, existence seemed a vain necessity's act, a wrestle of eternal opposites in a clasped antagonism's close locked embrace, a play without denouement or idea, a hunger march of lives without a goal, or written on a bare blackboard of space, a futile and recurring sum of souls, a hope that failed, a light that never shone, the labor of an unaccomplished force tied to its acts in a dim eternity. There is no end, or none can yet be seen. Although defeated, life must struggle on. Always she sees a crown she cannot grasp. Her eyes are fixed beyond her fallen state. There quivers still within her breast and ours a glory that was once and is no more, or that calls to us from some unfulfilled beyond a greatness yet unreached by the halting world.
In a memory behind our mortal sense, a dream persists of larger, happier air breathing through free hearts of joy and love, forgotten by us, immortal in lost time. A ghost of bliss pursues her haunted depths, for she remembers still, though now so far, her realm of golden ease and glad desire, and the beauty and strength and happiness that were hers in the sweetness of her glowing paradise, in her kingdom of immortal ecstasy, halfway between God's silence and the abyss. This knowledge in our hidden parts we keep. Awake to a vague mystery's appeal, we meet a deep unseen reality far truer than the world's face of present truths. We are chased by a self we cannot now recall, and moved by a spirit we must still become. As one who has lost the kingdom of his soul, we look back to some God phase of our birth, other than this imperfect creature here, and hope in this or a diviner world to recover yet from heaven's patient guard, what by our mind's forgetfulness we miss, our being's natural felicity, our heart's delight we have exchanged for grief, the body's thrill we bartered for mere pain, the bliss for which our mortal nature yearns, as yearns an obscure moth to blazing light. Our life is a march to a victory never won. This wave of being longing for delight, this eager turmoil of unsatisfied strengths, these long far files of forward striving hopes, lift worshiping eyes to the blue void called heaven, looking for the golden hand that never came, the advent for which all creation waits, the beautiful visage of eternity that shall appear upon the roads of time.
Yet still to ourselves we say, rekindling faith, oh, surely one day he shall come to our cry, one day he shall create our life anew, and utter the magic formula of peace, and bring perfection to the scheme of things. One day he shall descend to life and earth, leaving the secrecy of the eternal doors, into a world that cries to him for help, and bring the truth that sets the spirit free, the joy that is the baptism of the soul, the strength that is the outstretched arm of love. One day he shall lift his beauty's dreadful veil, impose delight on the world's beating heart, and bear his secret body of light and bliss. But now we strain to reach an unknown goal. There is no end of seeking and of birth. There is no end of dying and return. The life that wins its aim asks greater aims. The life that fails and dies must live again. Till it has found itself, it cannot cease. All must be done for which life and death were made. But who shall say that even then is rest? Or there repose and action are the same in the deep breast of God's supreme delight? In a high state where ignorance is no more, each movement is a wave of peace and bliss. Repose God's motionless creative force, action a ripple in the infinite, and birth a gesture of eternity. A sun of transfiguration still can shine, and night can bear its core of mystic light. The self-canceling, self-afflicting paradox into a self-luminous mystery might change the imbroglio into a joyful miracle.
Then God could be visible here. Here take a shape. Disclosed would be the spirit's identity. Life would reveal her true immortal face. But now a termless labor is her fate. In its recurrent decimal of events, birth, death are a ceaseless iterations points. The old question mark margins each finished page, each volume of her effort's history. A limping yes through the eons' journey, still accompanied by an eternal no. All seems in vain, yet endless is the game. Impassive turns the ever-circling wheel, life has no issue, death brings no release. A prisoner of itself, the being lives, and keeps its futile immortality. Extinction is denied, its soul escape. An error of the gods has made the world. Or, indifferent, the eternal watches time. End of Canto 6. Shall we have a little break here?
Well, the end of that one feels like we're being prepared for something, right?
It's like walking the plank.
Like walking the plank, exactly.
It's not going to be easy.
And there's this sort of sloggy feel to the end of that whole section where you goes on and on, endless this and...
Yeah, and there's no escape.
There that, and this isn't going to work out, guys. And
yes. And still we have that secret knowing, you know, that keeps us longing. Yeah. What a journey.
I'm still... I mean, I sometimes look at this and I'm still awestruck at the energy it took to write this, you know? I mean, it's intense and the intensity never lapses, you know? So it just took to write this, you know?
I know, that's what he did. That's why he lived in his room. He didn't want to be disturbed by anybody. He went into seclusion for a long time. I think he went in seclusion in 1926, if I remember that right, and then he left his body in 50. And all that time, he just stayed in his quarters and worked this.
Well, that's what you have to do. If you want to write an epic poem like Savitri is...
Well, the you
probably don't have much of a social life.
No, the writing was an outflow of his inner experience, right? He wasn't... The writing, in my understanding, is not the purpose. The purpose is his own discoveries. And then he writes it down. This all comes from his inner experience. And mother was said sometimes that she would come and see him in the morning, and she would have experienced in the night what he had written in Savitri. That they were always totally in sync. Amazing.
I imagine it like this 3D printer, just like laying like level upon level of the structure of the whole poem. The whole thing just gets written with this consistent quality. 3D, to it.
Much more than 3D. Multiple D.
Yeah, multiple D. That's what I'm putting it. Well, I mentioned earlier that I've been reading a book called The Three Body Problem, which is a science fiction book by a Chinese author whose name I won't try to pronounce. But in it, there's this alien world that people on Earth get into contact with. And this world has three suns. And the three suns orbit each other in this chaotic pattern that they're forever laboring to predict and to get a handle on. So their civilization is different. It goes through these multiple iterations, and somehow the people are able to like dehydrate themselves and rehydrate themselves because the weather patterns are so extreme between intense heat and intense cold that they can only really survive during these interim periods when there's a kind of stable pattern. But then those stable periods quickly revert to chaos, and the pattern continues again and again until they keep evolving. And each time their civilization is destroyed, it starts from scratch and it evolves again. But somehow it seems to evolve a little bit further each time. And finally, by the time that you know we get to in the events described in the book, you know they're at a place where they're able to, they realize that this sun system, this trisolar sun system, is going to swallow their planet if they don't find a way off of it. And they just happen to, because of another set of events on Earth that involved the Chinese Cultural Revolution and the chaos on planet Earth, they receive a signal from someone on Earth who wants an alien invasion, essentially, betrays humanity, betrays the human species because you know she's so traumatized by what has happened here. And anyway, I mean, this kind of endless cycling of incarnations and like evolutionary like attempts to you know reach beyond time, reach beyond the realm of nature and the realm of birth, death, suffering, all the you know the trials and tribulations and the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune that I think Aurobindo alludes to in these lines reminded me of each other and it's funny coming back to this because we kind of have an orbit around some of these books and I, we come back to this every couple of weeks, but then I also circle around other things and I have many other activities. And much to like my dismay, I don't get to just, I have to interact with the world and I have kids and I have problems in the manifest realm to attend to. So coming back to this space and coming back to this orbit is really powerful. And I feel like reading also has this kind of, even if we're not immediately in the experience of the text, like in this moment, it has an echo effect through time. It has this dimensionality to it that isn't just limited to our present moment interaction and engagement. The science fiction book is really interesting, The Three-Body Problem, because one of the technologies that the alien world develops is how to kind of work with the other dimensions, like in that are like the mathematical dimensions inside of subatomic particles. So going from using the fifth, sixth, all the way to the 11th dimensions to encode information. And they're able to do some really interesting things. Why did I say that? Because I feel that this text has this way of unfolding different levels of information in it. And we kind of, we unpack that in reading it. We kind of like take the unfolded strands of meaning and sort of unfurl them like in 4D, in four-dimensional interactive time. But there's higher dimensionalities encoded within that unpacked content. And that's what I think has this kind of lingering effect. It sort of trails and catches up with you, you know, as you go about your normal life or somewhat normal life or perhaps not normal, perhaps not at all normal life.
That's the amazing thing, that he is really describing all these dimensions. He makes them all real. We go through life, we have no idea. Or we get some glimmers here and there. And then he travels through all of it and describes it for us. Wow.
I mean, it's interesting how that's contained within a person, like within a human body, mind, you know, this biophysical organism, this energetic organism has like the, almost the code or the seed, contains a seed to be able to experience or perceive or know or encounter or be these other dimensions that are being described. Because we can only understand and resonate with this to the extent that we have kind of receptors for it, you know, within ourselves.
Well, that was his work, actually, to manifest this higher consciousness in his body. You know, that's what both Mother and Aurobindo were doing. Mm-hmm. They were bringing that. Here we get the high and low. Sorry, Jeffrey, but bringing this down, and that's, I believe, is the purpose of this, of Savitri. Why Aurobindo wrote this? To give us a transmission of those energies so that we can begin to tune into that, to which the body should be capable of. If their bodies were capable of that, then so are ours, you know? We're just more limited in consciousness. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we are going into the next canto? Is that what
shall we? Well, let's start with the first section and you know, end the break and then see how we
So, you lead us like to continue from where you left off. Would you start on the first page, Andrea?
Were you going back to the previous canto?
No. So we're going to move on, right?
Canto 7.
You only read half a page, so you could keep going on this one.
Oh, okay. Canto 7, The Descent into Night. A mind absolved from life, made calm to know. A heart divorced from the blindness and the pang, the seal of tears, the bond of ignorance. He turned to find that wide world failure's cause. Away he looked from nature's visible face and sent his gaze into the viewless vast, the formidable unknown infinity, asleep behind the endless coil of things that carries the universe in its timeless breaths, and the ripples of its beings are our lives. The worlds are built by its unconscious breath, and matter and mind are its figures or its powers, our waking thoughts the output of its dreams. The veil was rent that covers nature's depths. He saw the fount of the world's lasting pain and the mouth of the black pit of ignorance. The evil guarded at the roots of life raised up its head and looked into his eyes. On a dim bank where dies subjective space, from a stark ridge overlooking all that is, a tenebrous awakened nescience, her wide blank eyes wandering at time and form, stared at the inventions of the living void and the abyss whence our beginnings rose. Behind appeared a gray carved mask of night, watching the birth of all created things. A hidden puissance, conscious of its force, a vague lurking presence everywhere, a contrary doom that threatens all things made, a death figuring as the dark seed of life, seemed to engender and to slay the world.
Then from the somber mystery of the gulfs and from the hollow bosom of the mask, something crept forth that seemed a shapeless thought, a fatal influence upon creatures stole, whose lethal touch pursued the immortal spirit. On life was laid the haunting figure of death, and overcast with error, grief, and pain, the soul's native will for truth and joy and light. A deformation coiled, the claim to be the being's very turn, nature's true drive. A hostile and perverting mind at work in every corner ensconced of conscious life, corrupted truth with her own formulas, interceptor of the listening of the soul, afflicting knowledge with the hue of doubt, it captured the oracles of the occult gods, effaced the signposts of life's pilgrimage, canceled the firm rock edicts graved by time, and on the foundations of the cosmic law, erected its bronze pylons of misrule. Even light and love by that cloaked danger's spell turned from the brilliant nature of the gods to fallen angels and misleading suns, became themselves a danger and a charm, a perverse sweetness, heaven-born malefice. Its power could deform divinest things. A wind of sorrow breathed upon the world. All thought with falsehood was besieged. All act stamped with defect or with frustration's sign. All attempt with failure or vain success, but none could know the reason of his fall. The gray mask whispered, and though no sound was heard, yet in the ignorant heart a seed was sown that bore black fruit of suffering, death, and bale. Out of the chill steps of a bleak unseen, invisible, wearing the night's gray mask, arrived the shadowy, dreadful messengers, invaders from a dangerous world of power, ambassadors of evils absolute.
In silence, the inaudible voices spoke. Hands that none saw planted the fatal grain. No form was seen, yet a dire work was done. An iron decree in crooked unseals written imposed a law of sin, an adverse fate. Life looked at him with changed and somber eyes. Her beauty he saw, and the yearning heart in things, that with a little happiness is content, answering to a small ray of truth or love. He saw her gold sunlight and her far blue sky, her green of leaves and hue and scent of flowers, and the charm of children, and the love of friends, and the beauty of women, and kindly hearts of men, but saw too the dreadful powers that drive her moods, and the anguish she has strewn upon her ways, fate waiting on the unseen steps of men, and her evil and sorrow, and the last gift of death. A breath of disillusion and decadence, corrupting, watched for life's maturity, and made to rot the full grain of the soul. Progress became a purveyor of death, a world that clung to the law of a slain light, cherished the putrid corpses of dead truths, hailed twisted forms as things free, new and true, beauty from ugliness and evil drank, feeling themselves guests at a banquet of the gods, and tasted corruption like a high-spiced food. A darkness settled on the heavy air. It hunted the bright smile from nature's lips, and slew the native confidence in her heart, and put fear's crooked look into her eyes. The lust that warps the spirit's natural good, replaced by a manufactured virtue and vice, this frank, spontaneous impulse of the soul, afflicting nature with the dual's lie, their twin values whetted a forbidden zest, made evil a relief from spurious good, the ego battened on righteousness and sin, and each became an instrument of hell.
You want to finish that piece?
In rejected heaps by a monotonous road, the old simple delights were left to lie on the wasteland of life's descent tonight. All glory of life was dimmed, tarnished with doubt. All beauty ended in an aging face. All power was dubbed a tyranny cursed by God, and truth a fiction needed by the mind. The chase of joy was now a tired hunt. All knowledge was left a questioning ignorance.
struck by this line, and truth of fiction needed by the mind. That is so the argument of the material, the scientific materialists, that we look for higher truths beyond this realm, that that is just the need of our mind. And truth of fiction needed by the mind. I hear it regularly.
So I'm curious about this sudden descent. So it seems like, because I get the idea that the universe plunges into the nescience on a kind of regular basis, right? That maybe all the time in some sense. But this is being described as if it was in a particular event where this is happening. So is this metaphor? So what's going on here?
We'll keep reading. He will get it's intense. He will get there.
Okay.
There's no explanation right here. This is just, yeah.
That's not the first time I've heard that answer to that same question.
Yeah. You just gotta, we'll keep trudging through this.
Okay.
Shall we do another section?
Okay.
Yeah.
So, might as well. We're here now, so.
Okay. So, I guess I'm going next, I think. As from a womb obscure, he saw emerge the body and visage of a dark unseen, hidden behind the fair outsides of life. Its dangerous commerce is our suffering's cause. Its breath is a subtle poison in men's hearts. All evil starts from that ambiguous face. A peril haunted now the common air. The world grew full of menacing energies. And wherever turned for help or hope his eyes, in field and house, in street and camp and mart, he met the prowl and stealthy come and go of armed, disquieting, bodied influences. A march of goddess figures dark and noon alarmed the air with grandiose unease. Appalling footsteps drew invisibly near. Shapes that were threats invaded the dream light, and ominous beings passed him on the road whose very gaze was a calamity. A charm and sweetness, sudden and formidable, faces that raised alluring lips and eyes, approached him armed with beauty like a snare, but hid a fatal meaning in each line, and could in a moment dangerously change.
But he alone discerned that screened attack. A veil upon the inner vision lay, a force was there that hid its dreadful steps. All was belied, yet thought itself the truth. All were beset, but knew not the siege, for none could see the authors of their fall. Aware of some dark wisdom still withheld, that was the seal and warrant of this strength, he followed the track of dim, tremendous steps, returning to the night from which they came. A tract he reached, unbuilt and owned by none. There all could enter, but none stay for long. It was a no man's land of evil air, a crowded neighborhood without one home, a borderland between the world and hell. There, unreality was nature's lord. It was a space where nothing could be true, for nothing was what it had claimed to be. a high appearance wrapped to specious void. Yet nothing would confess its own pretense, even to itself in the ambiguous heart. A vast deception was the law of things. Only by that deception they could leave. An unsubstantial nihil guaranteed the falseness of the forms this nature took and made them seem a while to be and live. A borrowed magic drew them from the void. They took a shape and stuff that was not theirs and showed a color that they could not keep. Mirrors to a phantasm of reality. Each rainbow brilliance was a splendid lie. A beauty unreal graced a glamour face. Nothing could be relied on to remain. Joy nurtured tears, and good and evil proved.
That's a comma there.
But never out of evil one plucked good. Love ended early in hate. Delight killed with pain. Truth into falsity grew, and death ruled life.
A power that laughed at the mischiefs of the world, an irony that joined the world's contraries and flung them into each other's arms to strive, put a sardonic rictus on God's face. Aloof, its influence entered everywhere and left a cloven hoof mark on the breast, a twisted heart and a strange, somber smile mocked at the sinister comedy of life. Announcing the advent of a perilous form, an ominous tread softened its dire footfall that none might understand or be on guard. None heard until a dreadful grasp was close, or else all augured a divine approach, an air of prophecy felt, a heavenly hope, listened for a gospel, watched for a new star. The fiend was visible, but cloaked in light. He seemed a helping angel from the skies. He armed untruth with the scripture and the law. He deceived with wisdom, with virtue slew the soul, and led to perdition by the heavenward path. A lavish sense he gave of power and joy, and when arose the warning from within, he reassured the ear with dulcet tones, or took the mind captive in its own net. His rigorous logic made the false seem true. Amazing the elect with holy lore, he spoke as with the very voice of God. The air was full of treachery and ruse. Truth speaking was a stratagem in that place. Ambush lurked in a smile, and peril made safety its cover, trust its entry's gate. Falsehood came laughing with the eyes of truth. Each friend might turn an enemy or spy. The hand one clasped and sleeved a dagger's stab. And an embrace could be the doom, could be doom's iron cage.
Agony and danger stalked their trembling prey and softly spoke as to a timid friend. Attack sprang suddenly, vehement and unseen. Fear leapt upon the heart at every turn and cried out with an anguished, dreadful voice. It called for one to save, but none came near. All warily walked, for death was ever close. Yet caution seemed a vain expense of care, for all that guarded proved a deadly net. And when, after long suspense, salvation came and brought a glad relief, disarming strength, it served as a smiling passage to worse fate. There was no truce and no safe place to rest. One dared not slumber or put off one's arms. It was a world of battle and surprise. All who were there lived for themselves alone. All warred against all, but with a common hate turned on the mind that sought some higher good. Truth was exiled lest she should dare to speak and hurt the heart of darkness with her light, or bring her pride of knowledge to blaspheme the settled anarchy of established things.
It sounds like life in a totalitarian state.
Yep. Yeah, we have seen it.
One of the scenes of that book I was talking about, The Three Body Problem, is set in the Chinese Cultural Revolution. And some of the descriptions of the effects of that kind of a movement, that kind of a almost mass hysteria, this sort of this collective madness on the individual psyche, and how extreme it could be, and how reality warping that kind of experience can be.
And the whole thing runs on fear. Everybody's afraid for their own life. And so you get this immense isolation because nobody can be trusted.
But this was not really India, right? While Sri Aurobindo was writing. So in a way he was almost writing from a different almost the world soul space, or these are like events that people were really living and experiencing. Like this is all composed into, verse, but it's, I think, drawing on the lived experience of so many people, not only at that time, but of course, even now. We're sort of verging more and more into this kind of world of post-truth, where so-called post-truth, where, you don't know what's real, what's fake. Our technological capacity to virtualize, to create synthetic speech, synthetic, facial expressions and communication. It's, combine that with authoritarian surveillance, technology, we can very easily slide into this kind of dystopia on a scale, unless we're already there in some sense, but on a scale not... not seen quite before in this universe, or on this earth, in this cycle of civilization, anyway.
Although you said that he started to write this in 26, you said, or that he isolated himself.
I'm not sure when he started. I read he went into, he retreated, and I think at that
time. So if he wrote this in more or less chronological order, which I don't know, but.
No, he did not.
No, because Hitler came to power in 33. So maybe he was influenced by the rise of Nazi Germany in the writing of this.
It's possible. They were certainly very involved with that whole thing to make sure that he was defeated in the end. Yeah. But I think what he's describing is that this is some force that is ever present underneath the creation.
Yes, understood.
Yeah.
So not just the historical episodes that...
No. Yeah. In the consciousness. Can we do one more?
Let's do one more. I prefer to not go the full 2 hours, maybe closer to 90 minutes. So
that would be good for me because I didn't get enough sleep and I need a nap.
So. I didn't either. All right.
Okay. I lost track.
You're at the start of then the scene changed.
And I am reading?
Yes, you're still reading.
Okay, gotcha. Then the scene changed, but kept its dreadful core. Altering its form, the life remained the same. A capital was there without a state. It had no ruler, only groups that strove. He saw a city of ancient ignorance founded upon a soil that knew not light. There each in his own darkness walked alone. Only they agreed to differ in evil's paths, to live in their own way for their own selves, or to enforce a common lie and wrong. Their ego was lord upon his peacock seat, and falsehood set by him his mate and queen. The world turned to them as heaven to truth and God.
Injustice, justified by firm decrees, the sovereign weights of error's legalized trade. But all the weights were false and none the same. Ever she watched with her balance and her sword, as any sacrilegious word exposed the sanctified formulas of her old misrule. In high profession's rapt self-will, walked wide and license-stalked prating of order and right. There was no altar raised to liberty. True freedom was abhorred and hunted down. Harmony and tolerance nowhere could be seen. Each group proclaimed its dire and naked law. A frame of ethics knobbed with scriptural rules, or a theory passionately believed and praised, a table seemed of high heaven's sacred code. A formal practice mailed, and iron shod, gave to a rude and ruthless warrior, kind, drawn from the savage bowels of the earth, a proud, stern poise of harsh nobility, a civic posture rigid and formidable. But all their private acts belied the pose. Power and utility were their truth and right. An eagle rapacity clawed its coveted good. Beaks pecked and talons tore all weaker prey. In their sweet secrecy of pleasant sins, nature they obeyed and not a moralist god. Inconscient traders in bundles of contraries, they did what in others they would persecute. When their eyes looked upon their fellow's vice, an indignation flamed, a virtuous wrath. Oblivious of their own deep hid offense, mob-like, they stoned a neighbor caught in sin. A pragmatist judge within past false decrees posed worst iniquities on equity's base, reasoned ill actions just, sanctioned the scale of the merchant ego's interest and desire.
Thus was a balance kept. The world could live. A zealot fervor pushed their ruthless cults. All faith not theirs bled scourged as heresy. They questioned, captived, tortured, burned or smote, and forced the soul to abandon right or die. Amid her clashing creeds and warring sects, religion sat upon a blood-stained throne. 100 tyrannies oppressed and slew and founded unity upon fraud and force. Only what seemed was prized as real there. The ideal was a cynic ridicule's butt, hooted by the crowd, mocked by enlightened wits. Spiritual seeking wandered outcasted. A dreamer's self-deceiving web of thought, or mad chimera deemed, or hypocrite's fake. Its passionate instinct trailed through minds obscure, lost in the circuits of the ignorance. A lie was there, the truth, and truth, a lie. Here must the traveler of the upward way, for daring hell's kingdoms winds the heavenly route, pause or pass slowly through that perilous space, a prayer upon his lips and the great name. If probed, not all discernment's keen spear point, he might stumble into falsity's endless net. Over his shoulder often he must look back, like one who feels on his neck an enemy's breath, else stealing up behind a treasonous blow might prostrate cast and pin to unholy soil, pierced through his back by evil's poignant stake. So might one fall on the eternal's road, forfeiting the spirit's lonely chance in time, and no news of him reach the waiting gods, marked missing in the register of souls. His name the index of a failing hope, the position of a dead remembered star. I'll continue to the end of this section. Only were safe who kept God in their hearts. Courage their armor, faith their sword. They must walk, the hand ready to smite, the eye to scout, casting a javelin regard in front, heroes and soldiers of the army of light. Hardly even so the grisly danger passed, released into a calmer, purer air. They dared at length to breathe and smile once more. Once more they moved beneath a real sun. Though hell claimed rule, the spirit still had power. This no man's land he passed without debate. Him the heights missioned, him the abyss desired. None stood across his way, no voice forbade. For swift and easy is the downward path. And now towards the night was turned his face.
So that's kind of interesting, because the evil that he describes is much more the evil of tyrannies and oppression in the sort of larger social sense than what one finds in other older texts, let's say, about these things. So I find that really interesting. There's not much about the individual, the evil of an individual here. It's more about the evil of a culture, a society, institutions, right? So I'm not saying he won't talk about the individual later on, but I do find it an interesting focus.
You're muted, Andrea.
Thank you. The individual comes in there in only were safe who kept God in their hearts.
Yes.
In the middle of whatever darkness we go through, if we keep that beacon alive, we get through.
Because there is still someone passing through this experience. Someone, there is a journeyer here, right? And we're following the experience.
Following Aswapati is traveling through all the worlds, and he observes it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So, well, I was a little confused by the end because it seemed like we had passed through such a terrible sort of place already, and now he's turning to face the night.
Yeah, we're just begun.
What?
I mean, yeah, after this comes a world of falsehood. I mean, we'll be in darkness for a while.
All right, I guess.
Well, there's a lot of it in the world, you know?
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
Buck up.
Okay. We'll call it a day here.
Yeah, I think we'll call it a day.
Okay. Keep the light in our hearts.
Thank you. Yeah. I think it's a good place to end there. It's a good good image to carry forward.
Mhm. Mhm. Yeah. A little ray of hope.
Well, I think that between the three of us or the five of us, there's also a number of little rays of hope there.
A lot.
An array of hope.
Yes, yes.
All right.
Okay, we'll do a few minutes meditation.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you all. Have a good rest.
I will. I was going to say good night, but.
Not quite.
Good night.
See you next time.